Hello, this is TV Guide Magazine for October 14th through 27th. I'm Rachel Renner. We'll get started with Ask Matt. America's top TV critic Matt Rausch answers your burning questions. The first question is from Molly. She says, "The Emmys have never been more awful than they were this year. That they didn't see fit to give The Big Bang Theory, a wildly successful hit, a proper acknowledgement the way they did Game of Thrones and Veep was terrible. I expected the Big Bang cast to present a comedy award, and instead they were sidelined to a clip reel. And I can't understand why the producers didn't try to capitalize on the 25th anniversaries of Friends and ER. Rather than bad banter and shtick, the Emmys should do more to pay homage to the reason we're all watching, the TV shows." Matt Rausch responds, "All very valid points, and even if the logistics had worked against gathering the entire Big Bang, Friends, and ER casts, any effort to present such a moment would have been more appreciated than watching the dreadful Ken Jeong flop with his TikTok gag. So many wasted opportunities to celebrate TV during those 3 hours." The next question is from Linda. She says, "After the stunning success of Fleabag at this year's Emmys, is there any possibility we might get another season?" Matt Rausch says, "There's always a possibility, but for the foreseeable future, I wouldn't count on it. After her remarkable wins for producing, writing, and starring in the second season of the brilliant Fleabag, Phoebe Waller-Bridge told reporters backstage, 'To be honest, this just feels like the most beautiful, beautiful way to say goodbye to it. It does feel right. Go out on a high. You can't get higher than this.'" And now for Ratings by Jim Halterman. Premiere Week. Failure to launch? The 2019-20 TV season has officially begun. But did anyone notice? During the broadcast network's premiere week, September 23rd through 29th, ratings were less than spectacular overall, with high-profile new series failing to break out and some returning favorites taking a blow. In fact, looking at the average ratings for premiere week over the past 5 years, when hits like NBC's Blind Spot 2015 and CBS's Young Sheldon 2017 emerged, approximately 12 million total viewers disappeared. The biggest year-to-year drop, from 2018, 27.4 million, to this year, 22 million. Luckily, the news isn't all bad, particularly for a few returning shows. While the season 2 premiere of Fox's The Masked Singer, 8.0 million, was down from last January's series debut, 9.4 million, it did help Fox win Wednesday night in both total viewers and the advertiser-coveted 18 to 49 demo, 3.3 million. Young Sheldon, now without mega-hit The Big Bang Theory as its lead-in, lost 2.4 million viewers, 10.6 in 2018 versus 8.2 in 2019, but was still the week's top sitcom. The lack of excitement for premiere week, coupled with viewers' diminishing urgency to watch shows live, is impacting new offerings the most. 13 freshman series launched during the final week of September, but unlike in years past, no big breakout has emerged. For example, ABC's heavily promoted Stumptown was well behind 10-9 Central rival Chicago PD on NBC, 4.6 million versus 6.5 million, and fell in its second outing to 4 million, landing third in the time slot. CBS enjoyed some early success with the comedy The Unicorn, 6.04 million, coming in as the highest-rated new series, followed by its legal drama All Rise, 6.03, and hospital sitcom Carol's Second Act, 5.97. But compare this with 2014, when ABC's Black-ish debuted to 11 million live viewers, nearly twice those numbers. It's now in season 6. The lowest debut, the NBC comedy Sunnyside, $1.8 million, where the cancellation cloud is hovering. Of course, how we watch TV has drastically changed over the last few years with the game-changing additions of DVRs, on-demand, and streaming services. There is no denying that the numbers are declining for traditional linear as-it-airs viewing for most scripted programming, says Jeff Bader, NBC President of Program Planning, Strategy, and Research, noting that the increased use of digital outlets is changing consumption patterns and the pacing of viewing. Bader advocates looking at the full picture to measure ratings. To wit, at press time, the audience for This Is Us's season premiere had climbed from 7.9 million total live plus same-day viewers to 15.4 million when figuring in 6 days of DVR playback, 6 days of watching on Hulu and NBC.com, and 5 days of video on demand. Maybe Premiere Week needs a new name. And now for Good Medicine by Damien Holbrook. The Good Doctor, Mondays at 10, 9 Central on ABC. The Doctor's Secret Weapon. Yes, Dr. Sean Murphy, played by Freddie Highmore, and his fellow physicians on The Good Doctor are at the top of their game. And off-screen, the actors and writers have a great coach to help their characters stay that way. Dr. Oren Gottfried, the drama's lead medical consultant, tries to ensure that the cases handled at San Jose St. Bonaventure Hospital are as legitimate as they are dramatic. I present all areas of medicine, says the professor of neurosurgery at Duke University, who both weighs in on the validity of the writer's ideas and makes his own plotline pitches. It's rarely stories from my daily work, he adds, although Gottfried does pull some concepts from a journal of cool, interesting cases he's encountered over his career, which has also included advising on Royal Pains and Chicago Med. For non-neurological plots, Gottfried, who calls into the writer's room and presents upward of 20 cases per session, relies on a network of specialists who share with him their wildest tales of obscure symptoms and shocking cures. Some cases do seem so outlandish, but the fact is, they're really medical truth, he asserts. So don't go rolling your eyes during the October 14th episode when Dr. Claire Brown, played by Antonia Thomas, has to treat a patient who claims she can't feel pain. This is a real condition that comes with its own set of surgical issues. Plus, Gottfried knows there are armchair experts out there paying close attention to plot details. In fact, he's raising some of them. It's a pretty big deal when my kids watch a show and they realize the medicine's not accurate, he says. Better start saving for medical school. Dr. Oakley, Yukon Vet, Saturdays at 9, 8 Central on Nat Geo Wild. After kicking off season 7 of her show about animal care in the Great White North with a super sweet drive-through dog clinic, Dr. Michelle Oakley takes on the pricklier part of her all-species practice. On the October 26 episode, she treats a porcupine. Hopefully, she won't need to give the quilled creature any shots, because this is her only patient with the ability to stick her back. Chasing the Cure, season finale October 17th at 9, 8 Central on TNT and TBS. Host Anne Curry brings the first season of this groundbreaking medical social experiment to a close with a look back at the work accomplished by the show's panel of doctors and the massive assistance they received from viewers. Additionally, the team will provide updates on past patients who finally found answers to the mystery symptoms and misdiagnoses that plagued them for years. And now for the cover story, Supernatural, Thursdays, 8, 7 Central on the CW. End times. All hell has broken loose, literally. The Winchester brothers face a new war as the final season of the demon-hunting hit kicks off, by Ileana Rudolph. Story's over, welcome to the end. Those stinging words were delivered to the heroes of the CW Supernatural, world-saving brother Sam and Dean Winchester, played by Jared Padalecki and Jensen Ackles, and their angel ally Castiel, played by Misha Collins, by God, played by Rob Benedict, during season 14's finale. And with that proclamation, the deity opened the gates of hell, freeing a tsunami of monstrous souls from below. Those ghouls and ghosts included many of the troubled creatures the Winchesters put down there over the years. That's right. For the final season of the horror show that deals with angels, demons, and every entity in between, God is the big bad. Fans had known for roughly a month before the April 25th finale aired that the end was nigh for the longest-running American genre series ever, and the only remaining survivor from the CW's network predecessor, the WB. On March 22nd, in an emotional video message, Ackles, Collins, and Padalecki announced that season 15 would be the last. Making the decision to wrap Supernatural was a long and difficult process, recalls Ackles from the Vancouver set in late September. He notes, "We had exhaustive conversations because of the love that we have, not just for the show, but for these characters, this crew, and this life that we built here. Saying goodbye didn't seem real. It still doesn't." While looking away toward the metal Art Deco staircase in the Men of Letters bunker, which serves as a hideout for the hunters, Ackles continues, "There's a scene we shot recently that really got to me. Cass decides he's going away for a while, and it wasn't necessarily a goodbye, but it felt like that to me. It made me think about how it's the last time we're going to have a moment like that. It reminded me of the last episode of Cheers, when someone knocked on the door and Sam, played by Ted Danson, said, 'Sorry, we're closed.'" Even so, Ackles, who also directed this season's fourth episode, Atomic Monsters, tries not to show his emotions too much on set. Padalecki is not nearly as composed. He's the worst, Ackles jokes. He'll be like, "This is my last first day," and I'm like, "Shut up, you big baby." From his comfy trailer at the end of the day, Padalecki confesses, "I'm a nostalgic guy." For example, he has kept a script from every single episode, with the exception of a few donated to charity, to use for research, in typical Sam fashion, and for his own memories. "I have many filing cabinets," Padalecki says with a laugh. Both agree that Sam and Dean are embedded in their DNA, and they're not ready to give them up just yet. "We still have a long way to go," Ackles says. Tough as he is, the actor concedes that when the cast returns to shoot the last batch of episodes after the holidays, it's going to start to get really dusty in here. Colin shares a similar sentiment and connection to his loyal Seraph. "Cass is part of the fabric of my psyche. When I put on the trench coat, I feel like he's real, which may point to a certain psychosis in me," he jokes. Though emotions are running high, the vibe on set is far from gloomy. The silly jokes and resulting crack-ups in between takes keeps the atmosphere pleasant, but there is also a nearly palpable determination to make each moment count, not only for the cast and crew, but for the millions of fans waiting around the world. Luckily, number 15 is poised to be one hell of a season. The premiere begins mere minutes after God, who prefers to go by the moniker Chuck, executed half-angel Jack, played by Alexander Calvert, the brother's foster son turned foe. He killed Mama Winchester. To recap, God murdered Jack when Dean, determined to put down the young Seraph himself, suddenly lost the heart, which did not sit well with God, who reveals the showdown between the two was all a part of his plan. With God on a path of vengeance, as his favorite playthings were turning against him, a distraught Sam shot the creator in the shoulder with the equalizer. The energy gun crafted by God visits upon the shooter the same injuries suffered by the target. So it's a really good thing Dean resisted the urge to polish off Jack with the weapon earlier. Later, Sam's wound will bring him both anguish and mysterious revelations. Now armed with two rusty wrought iron fence posts and Cass's angel blade, the trio are fighting for their lives in the cemetery as Hell's ghosts close in. In the premiere, they regroup inside the walls of a sturdy mausoleum where they've taken Jax's corpse to safety. While debating an exit strategy, they discover they have company, someone who claims he can help with their escape. It's like Walking Dead meets Game of Thrones. White walkers out there, Colin says, so we have to make a deal with the devil to help us. It's a difficult pill for Cass to swallow. Okay, they're not dealing with the actual devil, this time around at least, but this concession represents just one of many difficulties ahead for the angel. From the start of the season, he is racked with guilt, caused partly by his inability to save Jack. For Cass to have been on watch when Jack died is a crushing blow to him, he says. As is the fact that Dean still blames him for the death of Winchester mom Mary, played by Samantha Smith, because the angel didn't sound the alarm about Jack becoming unhinged. Cass feels he's losing Sam and Dean, the only other people in the universe he has a connection to, Collins adds. Finally, Cass takes God's retribution very personally because, as an angel, he views God as his literal father and a supposedly perfect being. God becoming his primary enemy, bent on destroying everything he cares about, is a really difficult transition for Castiel to go through, Collins says. As a result, after a few episodes of chaos, Cass gets fed up and takes a personal time out before returning to the action. Or, as Collins puts it, he leaves in a huff. Stoic Dean gets his own personal crisis, too, as he ponders his significance in the universe. Dean's asking, "Are we just a ball of twine to God?" Ackles says, "It's up to Sam to get him out of his funk." Padalecki adds, "Sam and Dean feel outmanned and outgunned. Only together can they possibly overcome God's vengeance." Some things never change. The Winchester brothers will always have each other's back. But before engaging in any philosophical debates, the guys have an impending apocalypse to clean up. Residents of the neighboring town are, fortunately, mostly unaware of the infestation. After all, two handsome FBI agents have explained they're containing a gas leak. They've put a lid over it, using some supernatural elements to quarantine the town, Ackles says, adding that this is no permanent fix. The magic that's keeping the monsters out isn't going to last forever. Hey, there are plenty of other evil beings to take down anyway. Today's scenes, from a later episode, are all about action and are seemingly unrelated to the not-so-heavenly father. Sam and Dean face witches searching for precious books in the home of one-time super witch Rowena, played by Ruth Connell. These villains may be small, but they pack a mean magical punch. One spell in the hall outside Rowena's apartment sends Dean flying and then crashing onto the floor, which means that before special effects are added, the stunt guy already did his bit. Ackles is flinging himself on the ground multiple times. By the last rehearsal, Ackles has gotten punchy, and the movement is more about fooling around. A while later, Padalecki's face will become twisted by hatred as Sam summons strength and magic to brutally vanquish a witch in one impressive take. Even though Jack is missing from the action on Earth, he is still awake inside the empty, which is the void that serves as an afterlife for angels and demons alike. In the finale's last moments, he was being offered an unknown proposal by the new Death, former Reaper Billy, played by Lisa Barry. Jack will be a crucial part of the ending of the series, Calvert teases, adding, "Ultimately, I'd like him to achieve some sort of peace, but sometimes we don't get that in life. Maybe he can get redemption in helping the Winchesters and their story." Calvert fans won't have to wait too long to see his face again on the show, though. Who will he play? All he will say is a mischievous, "I hope you like Ray-Bans and Weekend at Bernie's." By the way, if you also like Walker, Texas Ranger, you should know that Padalecki has already been cast in a reboot that's in development. But he and the other actors share a hope that when Supernatural wraps this coming spring, that won't be the end. In fact, each fully expects the heroes to drink beer and save the world yet again, whether in a movie or miniseries or some other form. Of the farewell episode, Ackles says, "If I was a betting man, I'd bet that it's not the last time this family's getting together. You'll wipe your tears with some hopeful tissues." Sid and Judy. Documentary premiere Friday, October 18th at 8, 7 Central on Showtime. The little girl with the big voice, who grew up to be one of Hollywood's most tragic and resilient figures. That's how many people think of the Wizard of Oz star Judy Garland, who died of an accidental overdose of barbiturates 50 years ago at age 47. In this intimate documentary, her addiction and string of late career comebacks plays out against her relationship with third husband Sid Luft. Their love affair began shortly after MGM terminated the unreliable Garland's contract in 1950. Luft produced her Oscar-nominated turn in 1954's A Star Is Born and was there for her triumphant 1961 Carnegie Hall concert before they divorced in 1965. Sid and Judy director Stephen Kijak, who used excerpts from Luft's memoirs, read as the couple by John Hamm and Jennifer Jason Leigh, for voiceover narration, previews three key takeaways. 1. Garland's Hollywood story remains painfully relevant. Fans know the tale. MGM provided prescription pills to help the starlet work long days and then fall asleep, and monitored her weight. Her business managers embezzled from her. CBS tinkered with her variety series, The Judy Garland Show, 1963-64, then just canceled it. There was that talent being misused, abused, and taken advantage of by the system, which is run by dudes, Kijak says. This highlights, yet again, that problem of men trying to control women. 2. Judy isn't without blame for her dependency. We learn the lengths she'd go to for pills and alcohol, but the era must be considered too. While looking through old women's magazines for stories on Garland, Kijak notes, every third page is an ad for calm your nervous wife down, take these pills. It was part of the culture. 3. Her talent still mesmerizes. Side-by-side versions of The Man That Got Away from A Star Is Born illustrates the performer's power and control, Kijak says. She delivered as much intensity as she would on the stage, take after take, he adds. It's mind-boggling. By Mandy Bierley. Dancing with the Stars, Monday, October 14th, 8, 7 Central on ABC. No Dancing with the Stars episode packs in the showstoppers like Disney Night, an annual must-see. Remember season 18's emotional contemporary dance to Let It Go from Frozen by James Maslow and Peta Murgatroyd, who earned a perfect score? In the same episode, Beauty and the Beast, Be Our Guest, accompanied a crowd-pleasing quickstep from Danica McKellar and Valentin Chermovsky, while wrestler Nikki Bella and Artem Shevintsev wowed in season 25 with a jazz number set to Remember Me from the Pixar film Coco. Tonight, the competition's remaining hoofers draw from new flicks such as this year's The Lion King and live-action Aladdin, as well as classics like Cinderella, The Little Mermaid, and Beauty and the Beast. By Emily Aslanian. The Terror, Infamy, season finale 9, 8 Central on AMC, Monday, October 14th. Beautiful, vengeful ghost Yuko, played by Kiki Tsukasane, who defied attempts to eradicate her when she was haunting a World War II-era Japanese-American internment camp, wreaks havoc in the horror anthology's closer. She's got her claws on son Chester's, played by Derek Mio, newborn, and she wants the little boy with her forever in the afterlife. The determined spirit feels entitled. Before her suicide, she'd been forced to give up Chester, then called Tezo, and twin brother Jiro as babies. Jiro died young and is already back with her. To save his own son, Chester must find a way to appease a hunger, Yuko's, that can never be satisfied, says exec producer Alexander Wu. It's not a given he'll be able to. By Kate Hahn. Treadstone. Series premiere 10, 9 Central on USA, Tuesday, October 15th. Odds are good that as you're reading this, one of the Bourne action movies is airing on some channel, and odds are better that if your TV is on, you've been sucked in. So it's truly exciting to see fresh material from author Robert Ludlum's world of global espionage. In Treadstone, brainwashed and highly trained agents similar to Matt Damon's big screen Jason Bourne are woken up and given missions for the CIA Black Ops program known as Treadstone. One such agent, Doug McKenna, played by Sense8's Brian J. Smith, is a seemingly unremarkable oil rig worker in Alaska, until a random bar fight, the actor rehearsed that scene for 3.5 weeks, unleashes a combat prowess he had no idea he possessed. I tried to have a basic idea of what I thought Doug knew about himself, which is pretty sketchy at the beginning, Smith says. The producers and writers didn't want to tell me too much, so I would be as off balance as Doug. A Hollywood soundstage wouldn't do justice to the drama's breadth, so Norway's Svalbard Islands doubled for Alaska. Other locations, Paris, Budapest, India, Ghana, Taiwan, Amsterdam, Seoul, and Colombia. Whenever possible, producers opted to shoot in actual environments versus using green screens. Not the most fun for Smith in the polar region. It was so cold that for any scenes outside, if you had any exposed skin, we could only do 45-second takes, he recalls. Are there any assassination targets in Hawaii? By Jim Halterman. And that's all for today. I'm Rachel Renner.